This is Bob Mann in for Jim Inkster, who is off today. On this morning's show, we'll discuss the new science of political campaigning. The recent presidential election was the culmination of years of groundbreaking scientific research into persuading and motivating American voters. Are the scientists and number crunchers radically changing the way political campaigns are run? And how will the news media adapt to cover those new campaigns? We explore the new science of political campaigning with journalist Sasha Eisenberg of Slate and the author of a fascinating new book, The Victory Lab. And we'll talk with one of the leading political scientists in America today, Kostas Panagopoulos of Fordham University, who's conducted some groundbreaking research and field experiments into increasing voter turnout. All of this on today's show. But first, the news from NPR on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. I'm Bob Mann, filling in for Jim Inkster. On today's show, we'll be discussing the new science of politics and how big data is quickly becoming the force driving modern campaigns. And I hope you'll join us for the discussion this morning. In Baton Rouge, the number is 225-297-5633, toll-free 1-877-217-5757. Or on the internet, you can email us at inkstershow@wrkf.org. Do you worry that reducing politics to nothing more than a numbers game perhaps cheapens it? Is there any room left for instinct and intuition? What about principle? Are politicians now going to be slaves to numbers, especially the polls, when it comes to their positions on issues? How is campaigning changing? We're joined in studio by someone who has studied the science of political campaigning for several years. Sasha Eisenberg is a columnist in Washington for Slate.com and the Washington correspondent for Monocle, where he covers politics, business, and diplomacy. His new book is The Victory Lab, and it follows the maverick operatives and academics who are now calling the shots in some of the most cutting-edge war rooms, men and women who are transforming the highest stakes industry in the country, political campaigns. Armed with research from behavioral psychology, data mining, and randomized experiments that treats voters as unwitting guinea pigs, the smartest campaigns now believe they know who you will vote for even before you do. In his book, Sasha Eisenberg uncovers the secret history of modern American politics, pulling back the curtain on these revolutionary tactics and strategies which helped decide the 04, 08, and 2012 races. Thank you for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
So how exactly are campaigns changing? Is big data now the thing that is going to drive campaigns from now on?
Yeah, these sort of two big innovations have moved into politics in the last decade. All of this individual level data about voters and the ability to run statistical models with it, along with the use of these randomized field experiments that allow people in politics to finally get some handle on what is actually working, have sort of dramatically sort of changed the culture of campaigns. And a lot of things that were sort of mysterious have now become measurable. And campaigns have all sorts of new tools to sort of sort through the electorate and know whom they should be engaging, down to the individual, and how exactly they should be trying to move you to either change your mind or to get you to register or to go out and cast a ballot.
Talk about, when you say randomized field experiments, talk about what does that mean? Give me an example.
These are basically pharmaceutical trials for politics. And so in the same way that the FDA makes a drug company randomly assign patients to get their different doses and placebos and see what the impact is. Starting about 15 years ago, political scientists, academics began randomly assigning voters to get different types of interactions from campaigns and measure which of them actually have an outcome on voter behavior. And the first experiment is a random, rather famous experiment run out of Yale. These two professors, Don Green and Alan Gerber, created a nonpartisan Get Out the Vote drive that they with the local League of Women Voters chapters, and they randomly assigned New Haven voters to get into one of four groups, and a quarter of them got a reminder by mail on a postcard. A quarter of them got a knock on the door from a canvasser. bunch of grad students, and a quarter of them got a phone call from a call center in like Omaha. And then there were a quarter that were in a control group and got nothing. And then afterwards, they were after the election, they were able to look at the rolls and see who voted. And it turned out that the people who got the phone call saw no increase in their turnout. The people who got the mail had a small but measurable impact, and the people who got the in-person visit became far more likely to vote. And this opened up the idea that for the first time, you could actually take all of these things that campaigns do and spend money on and subject them to the same type of scientific measurement that that not just drug companies use, but economists started using decades ago and psychologists use. And it has opened up the possibility that there are a whole lot of things in politics that where you no longer have to take for granted the story of the sort of wise man consultant who tells you that this one time in 1988 we did this and it worked, so we're going to keep on doing it. But you can say, let's actually put this to the test.
We're talking with Sasha Eisenberg, who is the author of this wonderful new book, The Victory Lab: The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns. And if you'd like to join our conversation this morning, call us at 225-297-5633, or on the internet, you can email us, inkstershow@wrkf.org. So what got you interested in the story?
I mean, I've been covering politics and campaigns in some form or another my whole career as a journalist, for newspapers, for magazines. I had always known that there was sort of this crisis of knowledge. You know, you as a journalist, you go and you find the sort of person who looks most like a wise man around a campaign, and they spin you some stories about why they're doing what they're doing and what works and what didn't. And I was covering politics in Philadelphia early in my career, and I realized that if you started asking somebody, well, why do you think that, or how do we know that, and you follow it up a few times, you start to realize that there's a whole lot of folk wisdom about campaign practice that doesn't seem to have a lot undergirding it other than somebody's experience or anecdote so I'd always on one level I'd always sort of realized that this was a business where people spent a lot of money but didn't necessarily have a whole lot of authoritative research undergirding their decisions. And I became aware of the fact that not only – I was sort of distantly aware that there were academics that ran these experiments, but I learned after the 2008 election that there were people in campaigns who were not only paying attention to what academics were learning from these experiments but running their own tests. And I thought that this was pretty much the coolest thing I'd ever heard. I ended up writing a magazine story for the New York Times Magazine that ran a couple of years ago about this group called the Analysts Institute, this very sort of secretive think tank that the AFL-CIO helped to launch, and that a lot of groups on the left began working with to coordinate these experimental research projects. And as I started writing about that group, I realized it was part of a much bigger sort of geek subculture in politics that I, as a journalist covering campaigns, had basically been oblivious to, but that the sort of superficial stuff in campaigns, the rallies look the same, the ads look the same, the press releases look the same, but on the sort of you sort of go beyond that crust of the performance and everything beneath it had changed dramatically over the last decade, and I sort of wanted to tell the story of that. It's very similar to what, you know, Moneyball sort of showed going on in sports. And, you know, I think we've seen a lot of fields change when, nerds come in and realize that there's a whole lot of data available and that you can start questioning a lot of assumptions. And I wanted to sort of tell the story about how campaigns have changed because of that.
Let's go to the phones. Dorothy on Goodwood, you're on with Sasha Eisenberg. Your question?
Actually, it's a comment. I was with the Obama campaign for a year and a half this last election cycle. And when I got started off, I, too, am a former journalist. And I noticed that everything about data was important. And I noticed that when it came down to phone banking, we started calling into Florida from Baton Rouge, and we were calling independents and Republicans. And the independents were people who we could easily flip, and the Republicans we could either flip or they were incredibly rude to us. And I just found that fascinating. It was a fascinating year and a half, and it was one of the most valuable lessons I've ever learned. And now I too am an independent political consultant because I learned so much from that campaign. And I learned a lot about how important data is to a campaign, and these calls into Florida were not for nothing, because look who won Florida after all. And we even made a trip into Pensacola from Baton Rouge, and we knew exactly which doors to knock on. It was incredible. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Sure. You know, one of the campaigns have always had the challenge of how you sort of sort through the electorate and know who you talk to and who you try to engage. And for decades, campaigns have tried to use data. Until very recently, the best data we had was often precinct-level data. And so, or the very broad demographic categories that are on your voter registration form, gender, age, in some states, race, party registration, if you have it. What has changed in the last decade is that people in politics have been able to take those registration records and link them up with all the information that commercial data warehouses have available about you and run algorithms to come up with predictions. And the two predictions that campaigns care about are how likely are you to vote and whom are you likely to support? And what they've done The Obama campaign reduced these to a set of scores. These are 0 to 100 predictions of what they called a turnout score, your likelihood of turning out to cast a ballot, and a support score, your percentage likelihood of supporting Barack Obama. And these have basically become like credit rating scores for politics. And in the same way that a loan officer at a bank will not sign off on your line of credit or your mortgage until they have a quantitative projection of your likelihood of defaulting or paying off your bill on time. Now, smart campaigns will not send somebody to knock on your door or call you until they have a quantitative prediction of your likelihood of being a voter or being on their side. And what I think we heard from the caller is that those have allowed campaigns to make really informed, confident guesses about where they can have the most impact. And, you know, one of the things that we saw throughout this year was Republicans, the Romney campaign, sort of consistently made fun of the Obama campaign for their sort of relentless obsession with opening field offices and recruiting volunteers. You know, the one of the stories I wanted to tell in the book is how there's been this sort of renaissance of volunteer-based person-to-person interactions in politics. And I think we saw this, to some degree in the Dean campaign in 2003, the Bush re-election in 2004, certainly these Obama campaigns, the sort of culture of face-to-face interactions returning. Smart campaigns are not just thinking about how they can communicate with TV ads anymore. And a lot of that is because there is data and analytics that allows campaigns to be a lot smarter about directing the energy of volunteers and knowing where it can have a unique impact.
In about the minute that we have before we have to take a break, the Obama campaign really was on top of this in a way that the Romney campaign never really got it right.
That's right. I mean, just a massive advantage that, in terms of sophistication. Some of that is that there's, you know, presidential reelection campaigns are really unique institutions in American life. I think we often fail to appreciate how having 4 years in control of a national party mm-hmm. and a huge budget, the ability to plan and hire people from outside politics allows you to do things that you couldn't otherwise.
Yeah, they had 4 years to perfect what they created in 2000.
Yeah, and the Bush folks in 2004 sort of similarly, I think, took advantage of that.
Yeah, we have to take a quick break for some other business, so we'll continue our discussion with journalist Sasha Eisenberg after this 1 minute and a half break on WRKF in Baton Rouge. We'll be right back. We're back. This is Bob Mann sitting in for Jim Inkster this morning, and we're talking with journalist and author Sasha Eisenberg, the author of this wonderful new book published by Crown, The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns. If you'd like to join our discussion about what's happening to political campaigns and how it's changing, how data is changing the way that and field experiments and working with academics is changing the way that campaigns are being run, give us a call at 225-297-5633, toll-free 877-217-5757, or by email at inkstershow@wrkf.org. Why did it take so long for, the academics have been doing a lot of really interesting research for a long time. Why did it take so long for politicians to figure out they could get something of use out of this?
Yeah, for a long time, academic political science was still really detached, I think, from the practical work of campaigns. I write in the book about a sort of episode in the 1920s where a young political scientist at the University of Chicago went out and started running these field experiments trying to get people to vote in the 1923 and 24 and 27 elections in Chicago, which was, I believe, the first randomized experiment ever to take place outside of basically in the social sciences. But very few people followed up on that for like 70 years. And part of that was that it was really difficult for academics to get anywhere near the people who did politics. Campaigns, party machines didn't want academics coming around testing, measuring what they did, obvious for reasons I think we can understand. It's really difficult if you are relying on nonprofit funds like most academic research grants to do anything near partisan politics. If you have a human subjects review board at your university that's overseeing all of your experiments, you are not going to be able to do a lot of political persuasion stuff in the real world. And so and academics invested a whole lot in stuff like the national elections research projects, these survey projects that produce a lot of data about voter attitudes, but I think kept a lot of academics from going out in the street and actually looking at how campaigns interacted with people in empirical ways. And so it wasn't really until the late 90s that I think that that these guys at Yale sort of backed into learning the value of experiments. And what they found in that first experiment I was describing in New Haven, I think in the book I call it embarrassingly practical. A lot of academics didn't care. It didn't seem to have great scholarly value to know that a piece of mail reminding somebody to vote was marginally more valuable than a phone call. But if you're out there spending tens of millions of dollars on direct mail and robocalls, that is both exciting and a threat to you. And so, right away, people in politics, especially in the consulting business, either very intentionally ignored this stuff because basically academics were auditing the products that they sold, or a very small cadre of people got excited about and decided they should be doing it themselves. But the sort of way that consultants define their expertise, it's very easy to feel threatened by people who say that they have a scientific tool to assess whether or not it works.
You talk about, I believe in the book, I know I've read about it in other places, these academics who were welcomed into Rick Perry's campaign and use that campaign as a laboratory. Talk about that.
Yeah. So these Dave Carney, who has been Perry's sort of top political advisor since he first ran for lieutenant governor in 1998, is a general consultant, which is basically like a general contractor at a construction site. The person who, instead of bringing in the carpenter and the mason and the electrician, is the person who sort of brings in and negotiates between the direct mail vendor and the media consultant and the person who does the website and all that. And he'd become really suspicious of sort of consultants because he thought all of them, when they were giving strategic advice, were basically selling their services. And so you'd get into these conference calls or these strategy sessions, and the guy who sold the TV ads would always think that more TV ads is the answer, and the guy who sold you balloons and bunting would always think bigger rallies is the answer. And Carney was really excited when he learned that these two professors at Yale had developed through experiments the ability to test the effectiveness of some of the stuff the campaign spent a lot of money on. And so he read this book, Get Out the Vote, this anthology of experiments that Gerber and Green had published. And the moment he finished it, he sent them an email and said, hey, I'm about to spend $40 million on Rick Perry's 2006 reelection. I don't feel I have the ability to judge how to spend that money effectively. Do you guys want to come in and use this campaign as your laboratory? And they brought in, because they were two guys from Yale who'd like worked with Acorn, they found two Republicans who political scientists who had worked on the Bush campaign. And these four guys, who became known as the Eggheads, were basically brought in. One of them described themselves as being like the internal affairs cops policing the other consultants. And for it really amazing, for 3 weeks in January of 2006, unbeknownst to everybody in Texas politics outside of Perry's campaign, that campaign was randomizing its television and radio buys across 18 of Texas's 20 media markets. And for several days, they even randomized Perry's schedule. And when they were doing a massive volume of polling each of these days and were able to isolate in every market what the sort of unique impact of having Perry physically there doing a rally was, and what the impact of each level of television and radio buys was. And it was the first time that that a candidate campaign had ever brought academics in and given them this authority. The Obama campaign did some similar stuff this year, but this was really new and got at the sort of biggest mysteries, which are all these, you know, experiments have allowed people, academics, to get good at measuring the small stuff, an individual piece of mail, a robocall, a knock on a door, but the big stuff is still a real mystery to us. What does a TV ad do? What does a candidate rally do? It's very hard to isolate the impacts, and this was a big step towards trying.
We're talking with journalist Sasha Eisenberg, author of The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns. If you'd like to ask him a question, give us a call at 225-297-5633 or email us at inkstershow@wrkf.org. So these, if I were a political consultant who made TV spots, this kind of thing might, and I was trading on my many years of experience and my ability to intuit what's needed in a campaign, this might scare the devil out of me, because there's now someone else coming in who can go to a candidate or a campaign manager and say, I have quantifiable data, proof that this will work, this doesn't work, where the other guy sometimes is just going on intuition and his or her reputation, right?
Yeah, that's right. And you know, see, there's now a big imbalance between the sort of parts of a campaign that are measurable and the parts that are not. And you get this kind of continuum from, you know, TV ads, as you say, which still are, you know, this sort of huge mystery. What does a TV ad do? What does 1,000 points of television on a given spot do? And there's a robust debate going on right now among, you know, involving academics and people on the campaigns about trying to understand what happened in 2012. You know, the media story was that that especially the Obama Super PAC priorities did these, you know, hard-hitting ads about Bain early in the summer, and that the story that at least the press told was that this helped sort of soften Romney and keep him down, and that this was a crucial sort of part of Obama's strategy. It's a pretty good story. It rings true. But it's not entirely clear from looking at polling whether that's actually the case. And so much of our understanding of what ads are effective are based on the stories that people tell after the fact about them. And, you know, so you now have this continuum where TV ads still, it's really hard to assess their impact, but everything on the internet is measurable, you know. And so campaigns know down to the, you know, nth decimal place, the open rates, the click rates on every email they send out. They randomize the design of splash pages on their websites, and they know that if you move Michelle Obama to the left side of the screen, people are more or less likely to click on it, and their contributions go up or down this much. And so the sort of looming crisis of campaigns, I think, will become how do you intelligently make decisions when some of the things you can spend money on you can get really good data and measurement on, and other things, you do still have to rely on sort of gut and trust and how you balance those sort of competing impulses.
Let's go back to the phones. This time, Lynn on Melrose, you're on with Sasha Eisenberg.
Yes, good morning, Bob, my friend, and Mr. Eisenberg. I come from an academic science background, but I'm intensely interested in politics. I'm reading Nate Silver's book right now, The Signal of the Noise. I wonder if you know of any evidence or any data that's been collected showing the likelihood of moving a red state like Louisiana to more of a purple state.
Yeah, I mean, I don't at the state level, I think that's something that's sort of hard to measure. You know, there are sort of two separate ways that you can change the number of votes you're winning in a state. You can persuade people, or you can change the composition of the electorate. You know, I think one of the and that's something that you do by registering people who were unregistered and mobilizing people who were registered but not regular habitual voters. You know, one of the successes that the Obama operation has had in changing the map in the last couple of years, I think, you know, certainly demographic changes have made North Carolina and Virginia competitive, going from states that were solidly red for however many presidential cycles to ones that are now competitive or in the case of Virginia, maybe even blue leaning. Demographic change certainly contributed to that, but the ability to use data and statistical modeling to individually isolate new targets and was a huge boost. And newly effective GOTV tactics that are informed by these experiments have made campaigns much smarter about knowing how to register voters efficiently. You know, there are people who now can determine through randomized experiments down to the penny the cost per registering a net additional voter. And we know what it takes to mobilize somebody who is an unlikely voter. And so one of the things that I think is underappreciated in terms of how Democrats have sort of expanded the map have been that it used to be that campaigns or parties would write off entire counties because they didn't have enough of a concentration of their targets to go out and mobilize people. Well, now you can go and you can look in a county, and even if you're a Democrat in a rural North Carolina county where you only win 22% of the vote in a presidential election, you can come up with, using these scores, you can come up with a whole bunch of people that where you think that your get out the vote efforts can help mobilize people, and you can come up with a strategy where you're going to try to turn that 22% into 24%. And if you have a list of the 10,000 people whose doors you want to knock on in this rural county, you can go out and recruit 20 volunteers and open one office and have that be a project where in the past you, because you had to sort of write in or out whole precincts or jurisdictions, you wouldn't do it. And so I think that there is a way in which states like Louisiana or like New Jersey that have seemed to, that have not been battlegrounds, in different directions could become more competitive because their data allows smart campaigns to go out and find targets everywhere, even if and think about new ways to put together statewide coalitions. That it's dramatically changed the way that people have to look at the math of winning a state.
In a thank you, Lynn, for your call. In a few minutes, in about 5 minutes, we'll be talking to Professor Kostas Panagopoulos at Fordham, who has done some of the research that you wrote about in your book. And I wonder if this research, if these experiments can be used to determine how to get people to vote, to mobilize people, could it not also be used by people to determine how to suppress the vote, how to mobilize the wrong people, quote unquote? I mean, what are the ethical implications? That's something I want to ask Kostas when he's on. But what are the ethical implications that you see of these academics working with politicians, some who may be scrupulous, some who may not be?
I mean, I always – this was a sort of recurring feature of my interviews with people who are doing experiments where I would say we'd have a long conversation in which they tell me about all the research they were doing to mobilize people. And then at the end I'd – say, so tell me about the stuff where you, you know, test how to demobilize people, because a lot of the research has come out of academics, especially political scientists, mining behavioral psychology journals for things that we know motivate people. And it would seem that a lot of them would lend themselves to be turned on their head and being used to demotivate people. And time after time, people say, no, like, we don't do any of that. And it's not just because they're, like, good, civic-minded people. You know, it goes back to some degree that, you know, a lot of them are relying on money from academic research grants that would not allow them to go out and discourage people from voting and do have to answer to, you know, human subjects review boards and other authorities. It has kept, I think, the research focused on, you know, and the other part of it is that a lot of the groups that are doing this research outside of academia and politics are doing it under portions of the tax code where they can spend nonprofit money because they're mobilizing underserved populations. And so a lot of the research is taking place among groups on the left who are focused on turning out minorities and young people and women, but are able to do it without hard dollar campaign money because it's seen as a civic purpose. And it was one of the really interesting things this past year where there were obviously major efforts across the country, especially among those on the right, to make voting more difficult for people. But I've never saw any evidence that they were being done with particular rigor or science behind them. I think that the way that people who are, they just tried to make voting more costly or difficult or confusing, but it did not seem to have a lot of, you know, empirical research behind how to do that intelligently.
So the Democrats are clearly, based on the evidence of this previous election and the case that you make in your book, have a tremendous competitive advantage in this area. But it seems to me that politics always sort of seeks this parity. What do you see the Republicans doing in the next 4 years to try to get back in that game and compete in some sort of similar way to what the Democrats have been doing for several years now?
And then there's been this, since November, a sort of belated awakening of Republican operatives to the idea that there's a huge gap when it comes to, you know, the use of data, analytics, technology, and similarly focusing on get out the vote, field, you know, quote unquote, ground game mechanics. It requires a huge cultural shift that even if there are people who are sort of saying the right things, you know, a lot of the stuff is, as you know, Bob, is a threat to existing consultants. And so it'll take a big sort of work in the culture, I think, for party leaders to convince consultants that things that might not be in their short-term interests are worth doing because they're in the long-term interests of the party or the movement.
Yeah. So we have to take a short break. I want to thank my guest, Sasha Eisenberg, author of The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns, for being with us here today. He'll stay around. When we return, we'll continue the topic with Kostas Panagopoulos of Fordham University, who's conducted some groundbreaking research and field experiments into increasing voter turnout. Back in a minute and a half on WRKF. I'm Bob Mann, sitting in for Jim Inkster, who's off today, and we're talking about the secret science of winning political campaigns. We've been talking with journalist Sasha Eisenberg, author of The Victory Lab, and we are joined now by Professor Kostas Panagopoulos of Fordham University, an associate professor of political science and director of the Center for Electoral Politics and Democracy and the graduate program there in elections and campaign management. He's a leading expert on campaigns and elections, voting behavior, media and public opinion. He's the former editor-in-chief of Campaigns and Elections magazine, the sort of the Bible of for political operatives. He is the author of several books, including Rewiring Politics, published, in fact, by LSU Press, Public Financing in American Elections, and All Roads Lead to Congress, the $300 billion fight over highway funding. But for our purposes today, he is one of the social scientists who conducted some of the experiments that Sasha Eisenberg writes about in this book. Kostas, welcome to the Jim Inkster Show this morning.
My pleasure. Good to be with you, Bob.
So tell us about a couple of the experiments that you've done in the realm of voter turnout. You had some interesting findings when you started dabbling in this.
Sure. So first, let me just say that I was listening to part of the conversation with Sasha, and thanks to him and others like him, the secret science of voter mobilization is not so secret anymore. I think there's a lot of attention being paid to what insights social science can offer and provide. I started doing some of these field experiments while I was a postdoc at the Institution for Social and Policy Studies at Yale University, where Don Green and Alan Gerber more or less pioneered this research within political science by conducting randomized field experiments, essentially clinical trials, to try to figure out with a great degree of precision and accuracy what kinds of tactics can effectively get people to vote. And so initially the focus was on exploring what kinds of mechanical efforts, what kinds of tactics, like they had explored door-to-door canvassing and telephone calls and direct mail. We then started to look at mass media to see if the effects of mass media were different or if they were consistent with some of these findings. So we explored the effects of radio advertising and randomized things like newspaper ads and billboard advertisements to try to get a sense of how potent mass media was in getting people to vote. And we had some very interesting findings. Some things seemed to work quite well and effectively, while other things didn't seem to work. And given that most candidates spend most of their money on mass media, we thought that was a very fruitful area to examine, and we had some very interesting findings come out of that body of work. Increasingly, we started to pay closer attention to some of the insights that come from other and related social sciences, particularly psychology and social psychology, and helping us to understand the motivations that underlie why people do things, the things they do, especially when it comes to pro-social behaviors like voting. And so we started to leverage those insights to get a sense of how we might be able to stimulate greater civic participation. And some of the findings of that literature have been very surprising. For example, the surprisingly strong role of social pressure in motivating people to vote, to do the what they consider to be the right thing to do when they think others are watching or monitoring their behavior, was something that was unexpected and has really transformed how we think about voting. We think it's a much more social process now than some of the early political science literature and earlier studies have shown. And so thinking about it in that way helps us to design tactics and techniques and messages that might be more effective in getting people to the poll. So all of this is a precursor to say that my recent work has focused on examining some of those socio-psychological mechanisms, including the role of social pressure, but what I call positive social pressure, not necessarily shaming people to vote, but getting people to vote by making them feel good about themselves, by making them feel prideful, by thanking them, by expressing an appreciation for having participated in the political process. Doesn't seem to be as effective as shaming people into voting, but it is an effective way to get people to vote. And I think that it's a way that these are tactics that campaigns can actually use in the real world without suffering some of the potential backlash associated with heavy-handed social pressure tactics.
We're talking to Professor Kostas Panagopoulos at Fordham University, who has done some very interesting field research experiments into voter turnout. If you'd like to join the conversation with us this morning, the number to call is 225-297-5633. And I want to go to the phones right now. Kobe on Drusilla. Kobe, you're on with Professor Kostas Panagopoulos. Kobe? Kobe's not there. Okay. Kostas, getting a little more specific on what you were doing in your research, one of the experiments you ran had a pair of eyes. Talk about that.
Well, that was a fascinating experiment because I alluded a moment ago to the findings of some of the original social pressure experiments. And the argument that was made there by the authors that initially did that study was that people were reacting to an observability cue, the fact that voting is public information, and that whether or not people vote can actually not only be monitored but also disclosed to other people because of the fact that it's public. people reacted in some cases with some hostility to that message. They didn't like the fact that whether or not they voted was public information and that it could be shared or that it was shared with their neighbors or other people that they may know who may have realized that they had not been doing their civic duty by participating in elections. So there's a real risk to those types of interventions that could potentially lead to what social scientists call reactance or a backlash effect. But this was a very explicit and a very heavy-handed social pressure message by showing people their own voting history and the voting history of their neighbors. And so when I started looking at this and looked at some of the work that was done by evolutionary anthropologists, et cetera, what I found was that they made the argument that some of this, some of our responsiveness to certain cues and certain types of messages, whether they're explicit or even implicit, has an evolutionary basis. We're just programmed to react to certain things. And one of the things that they argue we react to is people looking at us, or even just something as simple as eyes facing in one's direction. And so rather than employ a heavy-handed social pressure tactic, I decided to test whether an implicit social pressure cue, an image of a pair of eyes facing in one's direction on a postcard they got encouraging them to vote in an election, could have a similar effect. And there was absolutely no mention of prior voting history or any indication that we could or had observed their voting behavior in previous elections. But I sent a sample of voters in a recent election in Key West, Florida. There were three different versions of the postcard treatment. One of them featured just a pair of eyes facing in someone's direction along with some text asking them to vote, reminding them about the election. And there were two placebo versions of this postcard. One of them featured an image of an American flag, and the other featured an image of palm trees. Given that this was in Key West, we didn't expect those to exert much of an effect. And, in fact, they didn't. But the postcard that featured a pair of eyes gazing at someone as they were reading this message had a very statistically significant positive impact on voter turnout in that election. And so it's more evidence that this social pressure element is something that's very important to people. And even when you use implicit, sort of subtle social pressure cues, the suggestion that their actions are observable or a reminder, it seems to be just as effective. In fact, the effects of the implicit social pressure cue using the eyes element was as strong as sharing someone's own voting history along with their neighbor's voting history with them and more or less shaming them into voting. So this was very surprising, but again, it does have some basis in research that's been done by even people in the hard sciences and evolutionary anthropologists who have found these types of effects in other contexts, for example, generosity in the context of behaving generously, et cetera. And so, again, this is more evidence piling up that the socio-psychological mechanisms that can underlie our political behaviors are very important, very potent, may even have an evolutionary basis, and we've got a lot of work to do to figure out what all those things are and how they can be deployed to urge people to participate in the political process.
So I asked this question of Sasha earlier, and to remind our audience, I'm talking to Professor Kostas Panagopoulos of Fordham, who's done some interesting experimental research into this. What are the ethical considerations that social scientists who are working for a university, in some cases public universities, need to be mindful of? Do you worry about crossing the line into working with a campaign, but also perhaps inadvertently helping that campaign discover something that might help it win an election?
Well, these are important considerations, Bob, and thinking about the ethical dimensions, it's critical. We have to be mindful of the fact that these are real-world interventions that are operating in real elections with real candidates that could potentially be advantaged or disadvantaged by these efforts. For the most part, these are nonpartisan interventions because social scientists often have to use research funds and other foundation funding, and therefore are required not to have partisan dimensions to them. In some way, that limits the generalizability of these findings, because we don't know if these effects would be different in partisan context. So we need to partner with campaigns to actually do this, because we can't engage in partisan work as researchers using research funding in order to do this. But I think it is important to constantly be mindful of these things. You know, we have to go through IRB review process, and human subjects considerations are taken into account in that process. I think the social scientists are quite try as hard as they can to design interventions that are going to be fairly benign in terms of the effects. But I think the maybe a different question, and certainly an implication of what you ask, is whether or not this technology, whether or not the experimental approach could be used, and could experiments be designed to figure out what gets people to stay away from the polls as easily as we can figure out what makes them go to the polls. Absolutely, that's the case. And so if people wanted to use this technology for nefarious purposes, we certainly can't stop that. And it is a reliable methodological approach to try to figure out what works, or even what works in the opposite direction. Social scientists, for the most part, haven't engaged in that research much, but certainly it's possible. And for people who are interested in using this technology to, you know, decipher those types of things, I think it's possible. But certainly that's not what political scientists are motivated by, and we tend to stay away from those testing those kinds of hypotheses. But it's important to acknowledge that it's entirely possible, and, you know, people could use the very same techniques to you know, for purposes other than the civic-minded questions that we like to look at.
We're going to go back to the phones, this time Paul on College Drive. Paul, you're on with Costas Panagopoulos.
Yes, I wanted to ask you, Bob, and your guest, what is the effect of, you know, I know during the campaign I was amazed at the last presidential campaign, amazed at the sophistication of data mining on polling, and the effects of that on voter behavior, like Nate Silvers, who was working on the New York Times. I mean, it seemed like you just had a lot better information than in the past, and some people relied on it, other people ignored it, but it seems like it might have a feedback effect.
Well,
I think you're right. I think, you know, there has certainly been a marked proliferation in the availability of information out there about the horse race, about the status quo. There's certainly been an explosion in the number of polls over the past few election cycles, as well as the growth of these poll aggregators who put all this information together so it could be manageable and easily digested. I think that it's important to keep in mind that despite this growth in the number of polls, there are differences in poll methodologies and other types of approaches that could lead to differences in the results. I think people are very interested in kind of who's ahead, who's behind this horse race aspect, and they need some help in putting all of this information together, which is where these poll aggregators have really been helpful in trying to summarize a vast number of polls in a very simple way that people can get a sense of what some of the patterns and trends are. In terms of the effects of that on voting behavior, I think that, we do know that there is some effect of observing polling information that people on the fence may be inclined or more likely to support candidates who are ahead when they're way ahead, et cetera. So we have to acknowledge that there is a potential link between the consumption of polling information and subsequent preference expression or support for a particular candidate. But at the same time, I think that we've gotten much more sophisticated in thinking about how to consume polling information in ways that take into account some of the methodological differences that could be accounting for the preference expressions. And so I think that things are getting better in that regard.
Costas, I'm afraid that's about all the time we have today. I want to thank you very much for joining us, and good luck in your future research. We'll be following it closely and interested to know what you come up with. Thanks for being with us.
It's been my pleasure, Bob.
And thanks again to my first guest, Sasha Eisenberg. You can read more about all of this by reading Sasha's book, The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns, or you can visit his website, thevictorylab.com. You must read this book if you want to know where politics and campaigns are going in the coming years. And thanks for all your calls. And thanks to producer Kevin Gallagher and WRKF's news director Amy Jeffries for helping me through today's show. Jim Inkster will be back at the microphone on Thursday. Until then, thanks and have a wonderful day.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.